Considering Biblical Sexual Ethics in the Context of Modern Culture, Part 5, the fifth talk in a series titled Ethics of Sex in the Bible, was presented by Jack Crabtree on May 28, 2014, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2014. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. Handout number 1, Considering Biblical Sexual Ethics in the Context of Modern Culture, accompanies this talk.
So there's tonight and one more week and then this class is over, not because I'm out of material, but I'm out of time.
Can I ask you in that regard, I've been wondering for 5 weeks, this is handout one.
I'm still on handout
one. How many handouts did you have planned?
Well, that's a good question. I had at least three, and I was contemplating a fourth, but.
So we have not even started, firstly.
Well, yeah. Yeah, so there's, like I'm saying, there's a lot more material that I would have or could have covered going into detail. Particularly, I was going to take a whole section looking at the key passages in the Bible and looking at those in at depth and in some kind of length. All that's to say that's not going to happen in this course this spring. What I would like to make sure that I do is get through the highlights of part two. I'll have a new handout next week that's part two, and that's going to look at the highlights, the basic framework for a biblical theory of sex and how sexual ethics, biblical sexual ethics flows out of that. So I will look at the high points at least of that next week. That's what I want to do. So I'd like to finish handout one this week in order to do that, and I may do a just a quick and dirty look at the end of those handouts. But I got a slew of questions that came through the transit. And all that's to say, I don't have time to deal with all the questions that have come my way because I just don't have that kind of time. But I would like to take up a cluster of questions, one of the clusters of questions that did come up, and in addition to the question that came over the internet last week. And then we'll try to finish the handout tonight after I do that. So the first question was the question that got asked at the end of the last session that had to do with the words that Paul uses to describe homosexuality. I believe that was the question. Aren't they more nuanced than just calling it homosexuality? And so do they actually map onto modern culture and the practices and behaviors and attitudes and so on of modern culture? Something like that. I suspect that what's behind the question is that if you go to those books or lectures or on the internet and find people who are defending homosexuality from a biblical point of view, that is, they're trying to argue that homosexuality is not contrary to the biblical worldview and the biblical ethic and the biblical teaching, and there are people that take that position. In fact, there's one that Peter pointed out to me here recently who is quite evangelical, really, in his theology. Believes in biblical authority, respects, or at least argues that he respects the need to be exegetically accurate and that kind of thing, and yet is arguing that the Bible doesn't actually teach that homosexuality is immoral. So I suspect that that's probably underlying the question, because that many of those people, I don't know if this gentleman does or not, but many of those arguments basically try to argue that when in a list of behaviors that are somehow considered immoral in the Bible, when Paul lists a list of behaviors and he throws out this word about something that's immoral, such and 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 such shall not inherit the kingdom of God. All we have is a word. And it gets translated homosexual on that list. And so I think the question is, but is that really what he's saying? Is that really what he's claiming is immoral? Is homosexuality per se? Or rather, are they maybe homosexual prostitutes? And so what he's saying is homosexual prostitution is immoral, that kind of thing. So that's the issue, I think, that is underlying the question. When we look at those words, and there are really only two of them in Paul, when we look at those two words, is it homosexuality that he's focusing on and arguing that it is immoral? Or is it something more nuanced, more specific, more particular than that? It's a good question. It's a difficult question because it's really difficult in that list to know what any of those words mean. I mean, what about the word for strife? Strife is immoral. That strife is something that is deed of the flesh in Galatians. Well, what's strife? What all would you put in that category? Well, without being native speakers or being able to read Paul's mind, I think it's going to be virtually impossible to get a really fine-tuned understanding of what that word means. We'd have to be a native speaker probably wouldn't have any problem because we'd automatically know in the kind of context that we're in when that word gets used, here's what people are talking about. But we're not native speakers. I can't pretend to be anywhere close to knowing what a native speaker would think, so I don't really know. So what would I do with that then? Well, we have a ballpark understanding of what it means. The ballpark understanding is it's some sort of homosexual behavior. Now, with one of the words. With the other word, I'm not so sure. The other word may have nothing to do with sexuality, even. It's the word for soft. Could be a cowardice. Could be cowardice that he's saying is immoral. Cowards will not inherit the kingdom of God. That's what Revelation says. That all the evil dogs and cowards are outside the gate of the New Jerusalem. So it's possible that if we knew more about the use of that word in the language, that we wouldn't even go in the direction of sexuality at all. It's possible. On the other hand, we do know from the literature that the word is used in the context of homosexual behavior. So it's the one that's translated effeminate, but in any case, I would argue I really don't think that's what he means. That I think that's a bad translation. The other word, it comes from the two words to bed a male, basically, to lie with a male. So, is it more nuanced than that? That's the question. So how would I answer that? Well, I'd have to be open to the possibility that it's homosexuality per se that he has in mind, and I have to be open to the possibility that it's something more nuanced than that. So how am I going to, in the long run, decide that? That's why I have to go to the whole Bible, the whole biblical worldview. I have to reconstruct everything I can from the clues that are more explicit, from the statements that are more explicit about the Bible's theory of sexuality itself. I can't just take that word and decide that Paul condemns homosexuality because there's that word, because I don't know if that word means exactly that or not. But does it make sense in the view of everything that the Bible teaches and everything the Bible says and the theory of sex that is constructed in the biblical worldview, does it make sense that Paul would see homosexuality per se is immoral? And my ultimate argument would be, yeah, it does. So given that the word has to do with homosexual behavior of some kind, and given that the worldview of the Bible would suggest that homosexual behavior per se is immoral, I would conclude then that must be what Paul is talking about. That makes sense. That's what he's talking about. So any questions from you about that? Okay. Now let me read the other question that I want to respond to here. My understanding of your visceral reaction argument, and we're talking about the word abomination, bildugma in Greek, and can't remember what the Hebrew is without looking. My understanding of your visceral reaction argument is that a properly biblically aligned person would be morally disgusted by certain moral transgressions. But considering that you also argue that cultural influences make it difficult, and in some ways impossible, to tell when disgust/conscience is righteous and when it is cultural, does the concept of moral disgust have any practical value to us? if we disregard conscience, how do we end up coming to believe the Bible is true in the first place? Is the practical value of categorizing homosexuality as morally disgusting worth the harm that such loaded language can inadvertently cause, considering the violent discrimination faced by homosexuals now and in the past? Even if you do not mean it in a hateful way, is it responsible to frame the discussion that way, other than potentially alienating and endangering LGBT asterisk members of the community? What does this type of loaded language accomplish for your intellectual argument? In your Levitical argument concerning the abomination, in your Levitical argument, you say that it is facile to say Leviticus's description of abominations are not helpful because so many of them are obviously cultural. It seems like your main argument is that it can be gleaned from clues, such as chapter placement, etc., which abominations are really abominable. To me, it seems like you are bending over backwards and overcomplicating your interpretation to fit the meaning you expect to find, rather than the other way around. Why would God rely on something so obscure and unreliable as clues rather than straightforward declarations when making such a fine distinction? Okay, I'm not sure I can address everything in all those, but let me get at it this way. I want to try to better explain what the point was that I was trying to make, that I perhaps was not as clear as I should be. Let's start here. Note that in our culture today, in modern culture, anyone who objects to homosexuality on moral grounds, besides being labeled a hater, in all likelihood, is labeled, the other common label, maybe even more common, is homophobe, right? So you think homosexuality is a sin, you're a homophobe. Why homophobe? Why is that the label? The original meaning of homophobia, if I remember my history correctly, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the original meaning of homophobia is the irrational fear that someone might have that I am actually a homosexual myself. I'm afraid of my own sexuality. I'm afraid of the potential and the possibilities of my own homosexuality. And so in my fear, I develop an irrational hatred, animosity. I develop a phobia toward homosexuality. I think that's homophobia. Am I right? Yeah, okay. So interesting that that's the choice, or that's the phrase. And I think there's a reason for that. If you're homophobic, you can get over it, right? It's irrational. It's an irrational fear. It's a fear that may be rooted in inner struggles that you're having and so on. But there's nothing valid about your reaction, your aversion, your, for lack of a better word, your negative response to homosexuality. There's nothing rational about it, nothing grounded in objective reality about it. Therefore, you just need to get over it. That's what you do with homophobia, is you get over it. So I don't think that's what people mean when they accuse you of being a homophobe. I don't think they mean exactly the technical meaning of the term, but they mean something like that. I mean, something analogous to that. What they mean is you have a completely irrational psycho-emotional aversion to homosexuality. Get over it. It's irrational. It's invalid. It's inappropriate. It's unfounded. You just need to get over it. Okay, so the point that I was making by going back to the Old Testament and looking at these passages that call a number of different things, and not just homosexuality. I mean, let me be clear about that. I called rapacious capitalists abominable. I called idolaters abominable. I called self-righteous hypocrites abominable, because those are the words that the Bible uses to describe those people. So there's a wide range of people that would be considered engaged in abominable behaviors by the Bible. It's not just one single select class of people. But what does that mean? Why does the Bible say that? Because there are certain kinds of aversions that we feel that we should not, yea, even we dare not get over the aversion that we have. And so what I argued in Leviticus is, in order to, much of the Mosaic Covenant is didactic in its nature. That is, God takes things that God himself doesn't care about, like how you dress? Does he care how you cut your beard? Does he care whether you have tassels on the corner of your cloak? Does he care? And there's all kinds of stuff that he meticulously prescribes in the law, in the Mosaic Covenant. But any real reasonable understanding of the God of the Bible is he doesn't meticulously describe them because he cares. It's because they have some kind of symbolic and didactic purpose that he does care about. He wants you to learn something from the minutiae of how you eat and how you dress and various other ways about how you structure your life and order your society and so on. He does care about that. I mean, he cares about what they mean and what they symbolize, but he doesn't care about the thing in and of itself. So apparently God took what is relatively normal. What kid wouldn't go yuck at eating earthworms? Okay, I mean, I know there are a few, but that there are just certain things that built into the human psyche, built into our kind of natural way of looking at the world, we have an adverse reaction to them. We find them gross. We find them disgusting, eating certain things or seeing certain things. If you've ever seen the old movie, really a wonderful movie, The Elephant Man, this man who is grotesquely deformed, but a beautiful, sweet human being, just a wonderful human being, but his body was completely misshapen. How can you not look at him, be repulsed by him? Because he's a monster physiologically. It's only by getting to know him as a person and seeing what a beautiful person he is, you don't even look at what he looks like. You don't even notice what he looks like. But what about the natural response of aversion to the way he looks? It's just how we're built. The monstrous, the ugly, the grotesque, we have a visceral reaction to that. So there are certain foods that the prospect of eating them, the Hebrews had a visceral reaction to that. So what did God do? Those foods that you have a visceral reaction to, that strikes you as abominable to eat, don't eat them. If you eat them, you're unclean. If you eat them, you disqualify yourself from participating in the liturgy and the life of worship of the people of Israel. Why? Because God thinks that it's immoral for you to eat clams? No. God doesn't think it's immoral to eat clams, but you think it's disgusting, and I want you to learn something. I want to build something into this law to make it crystal clear how I want you to relate to me. There are things that are not viscerally repulsive to you just sort of instinctively, but they are repulsive morally, even to the point sometimes they are so out there, so much a departure from God's purposes that you just immediately have an adverse reaction to them because of their immorality. Not because they're gross, but because of their immorality. They are immorally outrageous. They are immorally offensive. And the word he uses that is the same word he uses to food that you think is gross. They are an abomination to God. And he wants them to be an abomination to you. And the key is to be my people. I'm going to be your God. You're going to be my people. If you're going to be my people, I don't want you to get over those kinds of boundaries, those kinds of barriers. Don't cross those barriers. That which should be repulsive, be repulsed by it. And there are certain things that ought to be morally repulsive, so I want you to be repulsed by them. So notice, our culture says if you have a problem with the boundary between heterosexuality and homosexuality, if you think homosexuality is wrong while heterosexuality is not inherently wrong necessarily, get over it. There's a boundary and you need to learn to cross over that. Get over your aversion. Get past it. Heal yourself or go for help. You've got this irrational response and you need to get over it. God's counsel to Israel was, when you find yourself in a situation like that, don't get over it. Okay, that's the point I was making. That's the difference between the biblical counsel, biblical ethics, and the modern worldview, is when all is said and done, the modern worldview really doesn't have any boundaries not solid boundaries. I mean, we have temporary boundaries right now. There are certain things that people are still willing to say are, oh, that's horrible, that's terrible. And you ask them, and they would say to you, I would never go there. I would never be able to be in a position where I would say that's okay. Well, that's what you say today, but what, on what basis, on what foundation? And all they have to do is have that foundationless barrier, scruple that's there without any foundations, have people wear away at that year after year, decade after decade, and challenge it and ask questions about it, and give them a few decades and it's gone. The barrier is gone because it's not well founded. There's no reason for it to be there. That in my lifetime, that's what has happened with the issue of homosexuality. The younger generation is a whole generation that actually needs to be persuaded that there's anything wrong with it, because culturally they take it for granted that there's nothing wrong with it. That wasn't true in my childhood. That wasn't even true when I was in college. Well, where did that come from? Culture. It came from the corrosive effects of a culture that would just kept pounding away at a value, a moral value in our culture that had lost its foundations, just completely had no footing, and so it was easily washed away. Okay, so I wasn't in any way suggesting, as the question seemed to assume, I wasn't in any way suggesting that my visceral aversion to something is any kind of definitive evidence that something is immoral. In fact, I think I said quite the opposite, because we can have that visceral reaction for a lot of different reasons. Some of them idiosyncratic, you know, I just don't like it. Some of them are cultural, but moral is only one kind of objection that can manifest itself in some kind of emotional visceral aversion. So I wasn't for a second implying that that's any kind of evidence that something is immoral. The way we, how do we decide whether something is immoral or not? Again, we have to go back to understanding the entire biblical worldview on the one hand. On the other hand, I think I might have mentioned this last week, but the Bible was not given to us, and this is partly answering the other part of the question. The Bible was not given to us to teach us the difference between right and wrong. I know as a child growing up, that's what I thought. The law was given, we go to the Old Testament to find out, okay, what things are right and what things are wrong. We don't know the difference between right and wrong. We have to have God teach us. We have to have the Bible to teach us. That's not the purpose of the Mosaic Covenant. The Mosaic Covenant was a specific historical covenant with a specific group of people. I want you to be godly people. I want you to dress funny. I want you to eat funny. I want you to talk funny. I want you to be a peculiar people, but I want you to be distinctive in your emulating godliness, the values of God. That's the Mosaic Covenant. So the covenant combines all sorts of things together. The stuff about eating funny, the stuff about dressing funny, the stuff about having a peculiar culture with different festivals and so on, right alongside moral commandments to love your neighbor as yourself. And they're all kind of thrown together in the mix and all given to us as things that we're supposed to obey. Now, if the purpose of the Mosaic Covenant was to teach me the difference between what is universally and objectively right versus what is universally and objectively wrong, then God has been very confusing and very unclear, right? Because he's thrown all kinds of stuff together, and I need to sort through the debris to find out which of these pieces are actually moral instruction to me, and which of these pieces were for the Jews and have nothing to do with me as a Gentile. So God is being very unclear, very inefficient, and not very helpful if his purpose was to teach me the difference between right and wrong. But that's not his purpose. That's not why the Mosaic Covenant is there. The Mosaic Covenant is there to define a people as his people, and the terms of a contract that he's making with them that will define them as his people and him as their God. And for that, it's just fine to mix them all together, because he means them all. All of them are intended by him to be respected as the terms of this contract that he's making with them. So given that it's not a very clear moral instruction, then what am I supposed to do with that? I have to read each and every term of the contract in the light of the larger context of what does the Bible teach? What's the biblical worldview? What's its theory of sexuality? What follows from that? And what can a rational person learn from human experience in terms of the difference between right and wrong? Because even without the Bible, God expects us to have a reasonable semblance of the difference between good and evil, right and wrong. He wiped out the whole world in the time of Noah because they were unrighteous and they didn't have no law, right? He still held them accountable to moral principles that he expected were accessible to them. How did he expect they were accessible to them? Because he gave them a brain. He gave them reason that they could use to evaluate their own experience and determine some things are good and some things are evil. Okay, so in that regard, the other part of the question was had to do with, it seems like your main argument is that it can be gleaned from clues, such as chapter placement, etc., which abominations are really abominable. To me, it seems like you're bending over backwards and overcomplicating your interpretation to fit the meaning you expect to find. Well, that wasn't my main argument. My main argument is not that you have to glean it from clues. I was simply making the point that it's not as if Leviticus doesn't give us some evidence to go on to know what Leviticus itself is saying. It's not just a pile of commandments, and I have to sort through them one at a time, one by one, and evaluate them each on their merits. I could do that, but it's not quite that difficult. Because you have a whole chapter, I argued, I think it's chapter 18, you have a whole chapter devoted to the practices that were practiced in Egypt and in Canaan. The Canaanites practiced these things, and God drove them out of the land because of these abominations, he says, and he uses the word that I've been talking about. And there's only one of them that would be the least bit controversial, I think. All the rest of them are clearly things that are universally immoral. They have to do with fornication, adultery, pedophilia, incest. Are they all sexual? I think they are all sexual sins. I'm going by memory here. They're all instances of some kind of sexual perversion. And the whole force of the chapter is, now I don't want you to be practicing any of these things, because the reason I'm replacing the Canaanites with you and taking their land away from them and giving it to you, I'm driving them out because they practiced all these abominations. You can bet I'll do the same to you if you practice them. So don't you practice these abominations. Well, I don't think he's driving the Canaanites out because they're ceremonially unclean. I mean, it just... The whole force of the argument seems to suggest very strongly that God sees these abominations as truly, objectively immoral practices. Now, if you wanted to argue with me that the text doesn't say that, chapter 18 doesn't say that, okay, it doesn't. So now we have to look at those things in the light of the biblical worldview and the biblical theory of sex and sexual ethics, and then decide for ourselves which class should we put these in, objectively immoral behaviors or ceremonial ritualistic uncleanness, etc., that they're just the part of dressing funny and talking funny and worshiping funny that God wants his people to do.
Well, I think 18 is the most explicitly clear. I mean, to me, it's not unclear at all. In fact, it's like, wow, this is really clear.
Yeah.
But there is a part, I think at the very end, that talks about having two wives. And I was just wondering, is that the only place that talks about having two wives in the whole Bible?
In terms of a commandment about that? Good question. That I don't know of any other place right off the bat.
Yeah, because I'm always interested how... You know, there's just commandments and then like Solomon and David.
Now notice it's more specific than that.
Yeah.
It's not have sisters
right,
as
right,
your...
But I'm,
sure, right. Right, yeah. Did you want me to say more about that?
I just, as it relates to, I mean, because you don't see a lot of, well, you see all kinds of sin in the Old Testament, you know, very righteous people, but you don't hear about all those sins, you mostly hear about specific, like, adultery. I don't think you hear about bestiality.
Bestiality is in 18.
Well, it is in 18, but yeah. I'm saying the people in the Old Testament, like, you don't hear of that sin
being practiced
by David or by Solomon,
yeah.
but having multiple wives or adultery.
Right.
So I'm just wondering, again, because you said that, well, it says, like, in the very start of 18, that he is saying to not be like the Canaanites, but was all... Or were all those things actually being practiced, every single one at that time? Or is he just covering all of the bases?
By the Hebrews? I would assume...
Or by the Canaanites?
Oh, I don't know. But I wouldn't surprise... The Canaanites were a completely morally degenerate people at the time that they got driven out, so it wouldn't surprise me. I mean, the other, there's at least one in there that's not sexual. It's throwing your children on the fire to, I don't think it's Moloch name by name, but yeah, don't burn your kid to death either.
Yeah.
It's hard to see that as not moral. it's not a moral issue. Okay, so the question of sensitivity to a particular community, maybe I'm being insensitive. I mean, you all will have to be the judge of that. What I'm trying to do, my main purpose in offering the class, as I've said before, is people who have a reason to believe the Bible and the biblical worldview, and who want to practice the biblical worldview, who want to pursue the righteousness that is prescribed by the Bible, to give you some understanding of sexuality and the Bible's view of sexuality and sexual ethics, to be able to withstand the onslaught of the modern culture that's going to tell you, get over it, cross those boundaries, forget those boundaries, erase those boundaries, pretend like those boundaries don't exist. And I'm just trying to establish the fact that the Bible does put boundaries in place that are there for a good reason, and it's part of being a follower of Jesus to respect those boundaries and to learn to live within those boundaries. I mean, that's the purpose of the class. I'm not arguing with the culture. I could do that in another time and place and context if we want to, you know. I mean, but that's another class. That's another context. That's a whole nother event. That's not this event. This event is intended for believers who already believe enough in the biblical worldview that they would respect that as an argument. I mean, if there are people out there who don't believe in the biblical worldview and think it's all bullshit, okay, then don't obey. I mean, then biblical ethics shouldn't even all be that interesting to you. I mean, why would that be interesting? I'm assuming it's interesting to my audience here because I somehow respect the biblical worldview and I really want to know what it's saying. So that's my purpose. My purpose is not to be insensitive to anybody. I'm not really talking to communities. I'm talking to you as individuals, wanting to fortify you in the decisions that you're going to have to make about your behavior, your attitudes, your desires, your life. What are you going to do? And what I'm going to do is going to be partly determined by what I believe, what I know, what I understand. And if we want the Bible to instruct us in what we believe and know and understand and value, then that's my purpose here. If I have been insensitive to any community, I've been insensitive to a whole lot of communities. I mean, the rapacious capitalist community I have been insensitive to as well, and the idolater community, and the self-righteous hypocritical community. I mean, all of that stuff is perverse from a biblical perspective. I'm not calling them perverse. I'm not pretending to pass judgment for me. I'm reading the Bible, and I'm passing on what I understand the Bible to be saying to me. It's what the Bible is saying to me, and I'm sharing that with all of you in case you're interested. Okay. Is there anything in the question that I read that you'd like me to address that I haven't, or any questions that are a follow-up of that? Okay. I think then on the notes, I think we are at point F on page 10. Okay, going without sexual intimacy is not the ultimate in deprivation. I mean, there couldn't be a more graphic illustration of of the folly and foolishness of that perspective than what's happened this past week, if you saw the YouTube video of the serial killer in Santa Barbara. Why did I kill all these people? I want sex. The women weren't giving it to me. I hate everybody. I'm entitled. I have a right to it. Nothing worse could happen to me than to be a virgin at 22 years old or something like that. I mean, I'm a virgin at 22. Can you believe it? Is what he says. And he hates us all for that because he has been deprived. That's the ultimate deprivation that he's experienced. Now, not everybody goes out and kills people, so there's other problems. There are clearly other problems at work there. But what's interesting is, why is that even plausible to him? Because it's plausible to our whole culture, isn't it? I mean, am I wrong about that? But we get so many messages through so many media and through so many channels that are telling me that if you are sexually inexperienced, you are missing out on, like, life. You're missing out on life itself. And the self-pity that that can foster, the bitterness that that can foster, the despair that that can foster, is all based on a lie. That's not the ultimate deprivation. The ultimate deprivation is to not attain to godliness. That's what I was created for. I was created to be a godly and righteous creature, a created material being who reflects the glorious character of God himself. That's what I was created for. And there are many contexts in which that can happen. And that can happen in the context of marriage. That can happen in the context of singleness. That can happen in the context of sexual experience. And it can happen in the context of virginity. All of us have different life. We have a different lot given to us. We have different... all of us are deprived in one way or another. None of us have everything that we could be, that we could experience, that we could have. All of us have to face deprivation of one kind or another. And wisdom is coming to learn how to deal with the deprivations that each and every one of us experience. What am I going to do about that? Am I going to curse God and die because this is a fate worse than death that God has dealt with me? Or am I going to submit to the will of God and learn to know him and serve him and love him? That's the choice that all of us face. It seems to me, it's really been interesting to me and helpful to me as I've got a little bit more into eschatology. I think I'm more and more convinced that from the standpoint of biblical teaching, our ultimate destiny is not a sexual destiny. We will ultimately be asexual beings. Remember that Sadducees come and try to trap Jesus in a question about a series of levirate marriages. A man marries somebody, he dies without children. His brother marries the widow, he dies without children. The next brother marries the widow, he dies without children. So I think there are 7 brothers who end up having this woman for a wife, but there are no children. And the Sadducees smart-aleckily ask Jesus, "So whose wife is she in the kingdom of?" And remember, Jesus' response is, you don't really get it, do you? In the kingdom of God, we will be like angels. There will be neither marriage nor giving in marriage. And I think the significance of what he's saying there is, I mean, he could just be saying heaven, or the kingdom of God, is really hell because there's all the sexual desires and none of the sexual satisfaction. There's not going to be marriage. There's not going to be any righteous way to satisfy your sexual desires. Could be that's what he's saying, but I don't think so. I think the part about you're going to be like angels, I don't know what angels are like, but I assume that what he's arguing is you will be asexual. You will cease to be sexual beings. Now, I want to qualify that. That doesn't necessarily mean that we will cease being male and female. I think what it, or, right, that we will see, let me put it this way. I don't think that necessarily means that we will cease being man and woman. That may not be true. The distinction between man and woman may be eternal. Because notice that what's foundational to the difference between male and female is in our psyche, not in our bodies. It's a psychic difference. We look at the world differently, we experience the world differently, and as I will talk about a little bit next week, that's one of the challenges of marriage, but I think it's one of the purposes of marriage. To have a commitment of love across the most significant difference that exists in human experience between two human beings. I think it goes deeper than culture. It goes deeper than individual experience. The male-female difference is about as different as you can get. And yet what we're called to is become one with that human being that is so odd, is so other than you, is so different than you, is so mysterious and inexplicable to you, but become one with them. And that becomes the challenge of marriage. It's the challenge of marriage, it's the blessing of marriage, and I think it's the purpose of marriage. Okay, we'll come back to that next week. But given that it's playing that role here, it may very well be that man and woman is an eternal distinction. But I will cease to be sexually a man, I will be psychically a man, and I will cease to be sexually a woman, I will be psychically a woman. Or not. Maybe we'll be all be the same. But understanding that my biological sexuality will go away is really helpful picture of understanding that it's not at the essence, therefore, of who I am. It's not what makes me me, and it's not what makes a human being a human being, and it's not what makes me the creature of God that God intended from the very beginning. Something else determines that, and it's not my sexuality. Now, I've already talked about that in another context, but in this context, therefore, going my whole life and being deprived of sexual satisfaction, okay, then I go my whole life and I'm deprived of sexual satisfaction. The blind man goes his whole life and is deprived of seeing. The deaf man goes his whole life and is deprived of hearing. It happens. We have a different journey that we're on. We have a different context that God has put us in. But somehow we elevate this deprivation to, this is insufferable. We can't possibly go without sex. Okay, questions on that?
I was just wondering, I'm sure you've thought about this, but why God actually gave us this, you know, like sexualness?
Wouldn't be any kids otherwise.
Well, there's that, I know, but other than that.
One of the things that I think is very interesting to ask is, why did he make sex pleasurable?
Okay, well, that's probably all tied together.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And I suspect it. I mean, we could look at that and say, I'm sure this guy who made this YouTube video would say it if he would even allow God in the conversation, that he made it to torture us, right? Okay, he made it to torture us, but in a good way. I mean, how much of my life has been excruciatingly painful because there was such a tension between what I wanted and what God was going to give to me. And I thrashed against that, and I screamed against that, and I resisted that, and almost drove myself literally crazy trying to make reality be what I wanted reality to be because I couldn't tolerate it being different than that, and almost drove myself crazy. But those excruciatingly painful times were the most precious times of my life because it's in those times that I became wise to the extent that I did. I mean, those times, I think, burned certain perspectives deep into my soul that had to be there in the soul of anyone who could make any claim to wisdom. And God could have come and talked to me all day long for eternity, and I wouldn't have gotten it. I mean, I would have intellectually agreed with him. Yeah, you're right. Yeah. That's how a human being should be, that's what's valuable, that's what's important, and so on. But when you have to suffer in the confrontation with what's valuable, what's important, you come out the other end of that really believing that that's what's valuable, and that's what's important, and that's what you want to base your life on, and that's the direction you want to go. So it's entirely possible to me that God built into humanity this excruciatingly difficult task to experience sexual desire and yet have to live as a moral being that requires us sometimes to say no to our sexual desire. And that tension between what I want and what I ought to do puts us in that very uncomfortable position in which we can learn wisdom if we will learn it. See, that young man in Santa Barbara was in that very, very uncomfortable position, and instead of letting it break him, break his resistance to God and truth and morality and a certain perspective on love and justice and truth, he just got bitter, more and more and more and more bitter and hateful. It's either going to make us or it's going to break us. And sometimes it breaks us.
I was thinking actually more in the context of marriage than in...
Oh. Well, same is true in marriage.
That it's this off and then it's on. I mean, anyway, I don't want to take up more time, but it's just a strange thing.
Yeah. No. I mean, if you step back and get any objectivity toward it all, sex is weird. What a weird thing. But it's part of what we have to deal with. Yeah.
The question that comes to mind, I think it is a really interesting point that, you know, life is pain, life is deprivation. We can't hope to go through life without pain. And from the biblical perspective, it seems that God intends that pain as a catalyst for growth. But at the same time, throughout the Bible, we see, you know, the natural human inclination is to want a way out of pain, out of deprivation. And it would seem that God thinks that's a good thing. Like when the blind men come to Jesus, he doesn't say, no, your blindness is your blindness is your gift from God. He heals them. And, you know, when people are hungry, he doesn't just write off their hunger. And,
good for you.
Exactly. So, with reference to sexuality, I think that the obvious question that comes back is, blindness is something you deal with because you don't have a choice.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do have a choice, then most Christian theologians would say the sensible thing is get LASIK. Do something about it and don't be miserable anymore. Why would that same choice not apply in the case of homosexuality?
Okay.
Whereas, like, there is an obvious way out, but you're not supposed to take it.
Okay. Well, because that's right, the analogy between blindness and sexuality breaks down precisely in there are no choices. I mean, if I'm blind from birth and it's congenital and there are no cures, I don't even have the option of alleviating my condition. With sexual desire, there is an option to alleviate my condition, but is it righteous? And so what it does is it puts me in a position where I have to choose. I can simply alleviate my suffering, but I have to be immoral to do it. I have to do something immoral to do it. Or I can choose righteousness. I can choose to continue being deprived, but because I'm choosing righteousness. Well, that's a great choice for us to face into, because I have to decide how important righteousness is to me at a time like that. And that's what I mean by it's in that choice that I learn wisdom. I learn, and here's what I mean by learn wisdom. It's not an intellectual thing. It's in that choice that I resolve my will to make my commitment toward the righteousness that God wants me to go toward instead of blowing it off. And when I make that commitment, I'm changing who I am. I'm defining who I am by that choice. And that, so, yes, there's always the choice of immorality, that's true, but that would be a foolish choice, I think, according to biblical perspective. And there are other things like that. I mean, one way to alleviate suffering is lying as well. We face the same problem there. I can lie and make my situation more comfortable in some way, or I can tell the truth, because it would be to deceive people is just wrong.
I think that was a really good question, because I think a lot of times in Christian history, like, suffering, there was this idea that suffering is better. So starve yourself to get closer to God, or deprive yourself of a sexual relationship, even in the context of marriage, because that will make you more godly, because God likes suffering, and that's where growth happens. So makes total sense to give yourself the most opportunity to have growth as possible, give yourself the most amount of suffering as possible. But it doesn't sound like that's what you're saying. You're looking at here's the lot in life that God has given you. If he's given you a lot in life where sexual gratification is not open to you, except for being immoral, whatever your orientation is, just given your situation, then it would be immoral for you to, you're saying it would be immoral for you to do that, and you will, on the flip side, you will experience growth if you follow the path that God is pushing you.
Yeah, and that's a great point. Suffering as such does not make us wise. It's the trials and temptations, it's the tribulations in the hand of God that make us wise. Those tribulations don't always have to actually be suffering. Sometimes it's the opposite of suffering that are the tribulations. But it's when God pushes on me by constraining me and limiting me and taking stuff away and adding adversity to my life, he has a purpose in mind. And the purpose is to put me in a situation where I'm going to have to make a choice, and that choice is going to make me, if I will make the wise choice. And that's what God is in the business of doing. So suffering as such doesn't make me a better person. That's why it makes no sense to self-inflicted suffering, because I'm not a very good sanctifier of myself. I mean, just to make myself suffer, just for the sake of making myself suffer, that doesn't make any sense biblically. It's God who's in control, who's the choreographer, who's the architect of those sufferings that are going to sanctify me. I mean, Paul specifically says, you're going to deprive yourself of, you married people are going to deprive yourself of sex. Well, only for a season, and only to devote yourself to prayer, whatever he means by that. I mean, he's very cautious about that. He's saying, well, if you got to deprive yourself, then okay. But he's not about to say it's inherently good to do that, and the more you deprive yourself, the better. He doesn't say that. Plato might say that, but Paul's not going to say that.
I was just thinking, it's a lot of the time the line between the line between how you're talking about the biblical worldview and Platonism can sometimes seem very thin, and that's why I think they have been so enmeshed throughout history, is because I was kind of thinking about that. There are times where it's like a hair away from Platonism. But at the same time, how they're really different.
Yeah.
It's a totally different picture of humanity.
And that's where we have to be knowledgeable enough. We have to understand enough. We need to be sophisticated enough and in our thinking to be able to discern the difference between a kind of Platonic rejection of sexuality and the biblical perspective on sexuality. They're worlds apart, and yet they can look so similar in certain contexts. To a certain extent. But they're ultimately very, very different worldviews. And we have to understand that. You know?
That just because there are boundaries on sexual expression and behavior doesn't make it bad, I guess, would be.
Right.
Like Platonism would say, it's all bad.
Right. Right.
Therefore, don't worry about the boundaries. You know, like, make it all off limits.
Right.
But there's like a middle ground there that is...
That the attitude that I picked up when I was a young man back in the mid 20th century, way back then, was kind of, to come back to your question, that when you got married, that was a license to have a ready sexual partner whenever you wanted it. Well, obviously it doesn't work that way. There's another human being involved. And when there's another human being involved, morality becomes involved. And when morality becomes involved, the same thing we were talking about earlier becomes involved. Am I going to love my spouse or use my spouse? And that becomes then the issue. Just because I have a sexual desire is not a license to gratify it, even in the context of marriage. I still have to consider morality, righteousness, goodness, love. Those are more important than sexual gratification. So... The ethics of sex does not stop at the wedding ceremony. It's still an ethical issue throughout our lives. It just changes context.
So are you going to talk about specific boundaries in marriage?
I can. The only thing I was going to say is I think that there are still another. I'll talk about it now. Another thing that came with that, I think, is the perspective that there was no such thing as sexual perversion in between a husband and his wife. And I think that's kind of the attitude that I assumed and picked up. And I think I've come to see, no, that's very terribly wrong. We still have to ask ourselves the question, is this what God had in mind when he made us sexual beings? Is this practice, is this behavior, is this thing that I want to do in keeping with what God had in mind? Or am I perverting what God had in mind? I think we still have to ask that question. And I can answer that question for myself, but you know, I just think the important thing is that we all recognize the need to ask ourselves that question and not be intimidated by the culture. I mean, back to my last point, the culture ultimately is telling me there are no boundaries. That's what the culture is telling me. So you got a sexual hang-up. We go to a sex therapist, and the sex therapist tells us to get over our hang-ups. You know, just do anything, do everything. Don't even worry about what it is that you're doing. Don't even worry about your sexual behaviors, because it's just any hesitancy you have to be adventurous sexually is just a hang-up on your part. Get over it. Well, what if my hang-up is, I think that's actually immoral? So I'm much more prepared to say today that I think there is such a thing as sexually perverse behavior, even within the context of marriage.
So I'm going to ask you again if you can be specific. Is it possible if you be specific? Embarrassing. No, because I hear what you're saying, but like in the context of Leviticus 18, it's very clear, it's very spelled out, you know, we're not doing those things, but then you say there are boundaries and we have to consent, we have to be loving. But what if you're both loving?
No, that's okay. That was always the boundary that I recognized. Surely that has to be the boundary. You have to be loving. So your spouse needs to consent.
I'm saying is okay. There's so much out there. I mean, there's just, it's not talked about.
Right.
It's not talked
right.
about in a Christian circle.
Right.
And in a culture outside of the Christian circle, it's like you said, anything goes as long as you're satisfying each other. Mm-hmm. You know, like, you know, do like go to these movies, go do this or that or that, or read this book. Mm-hmm. But so I'm just saying, I would like to know, because I've never heard anyone say what the boundaries are. I've never had any teaching myself. I wasn't raised a Christian, you know, when I was 18. I didn't have any teaching. And even if, and even my daughter right now, I think I'm mostly like talking for my daughter. Well, she wouldn't think that, but as a concerned parent, because there's so much out there, even within like young life, whatever it is, that's teaching all kinds of things. So I'm just wondering what your specific perspective is, and I don't know if you're willing to tell me.
I'll give you the whole long list of my, let me give you a shorter list that, because I think these would be relatively uncontroversial. And the reason I'm not afraid of controversy. It's not that I don't want to be controversial, but the problem is I don't know that I could prove my judgment on some of these things, and so I don't want to be imposing my own personal judgment when I really don't have the confidence that I really know if I'm right or not necessarily. But let's take something like sadomasochism in marriage. Is it okay in marriage? I don't think so.
Well, that seems actually clearer to me. I mean, I'm saying that I think that actually is wrong, and I can see that's wrong.
Okay.
So are you saying only the things that you listed are actually wrong in marriage, or are you talking about other things? Because I thought you were talking about other things are wrong in marriage.
I'm sorry, I'm confused by the question.
Okay, it's hard to discuss.
I'm stating things that I think should be obvious to all of us. The point that I'm making is when I say some things are perverse, even in the context of marriage, I hope that's obvious that these are perverse. sadomasochism, even if they are both consenting, right?
Yeah, those are. That doesn't make it. I'm talking about, you know, I'm just going to, should I just, like, say a word or not? Right.
If you what?
Okay, someone help me. Okay.
We can talk privately, and when we can talk about that privately.
I would like to know if there's specific things other than what's in here that isn't okay.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
I think so. I mean, a lot of the stuff that we have talked about, I don't think that is exhaustive of the things that are sexually perverse.
That's clear.
Okay. You're really like page 8, is that what you're...
No, I mean, that's clear. I mean, that's obvious. I'm not talking about that.
Mm-hmm. So when you determine these kind of things, I mean, is there like some sort of principle from which you deduce these things, or are you just going off of like, okay, that sounds like, oh, I have this real reaction to that?
It's a principled thing for me, and the principle is, the principle is based on what I'm going to talk about next week.
Okay.
If I think I am clear about the purpose of sexuality, that's going to make a difference in the moral judgment I'm going to make about what sexual behaviors and sexual practices are consistent with that purpose. That's what I'm arguing. And I don't think every sexual practice is consistent with the purpose that God gave us, sexuality.
Just make an observation that is really, I think, pretty self-evident, and that is that our culture, when you think about what is portrayed in our culture, what is in the PG movies you go to, much less the R-rated movies you go to, what's in the magazines that are at the checkout stand, those things have so dramatically shaped
mm-hmm.
an entire generation's
understanding
exactly. of what's okay and what's not okay. What's relationally going to contribute to intimacy, and it is amazing to me to, and it's in our culture and other cultures. You know, when you read about there's a story, an article months ago that I cut out about what's going on in Japan, where they're not even bothering to get married. So many men are not even bothering to get married because they have all the sex that they want on their computers. And so, why bother with a relationship that's messy and difficult and hard to cultivate? And just the boundaries of what sexual activities are and are not okay have been dramatically reshaped by our culture right now.
Yeah, that's my point. And in private, I'd be glad to be as specific as you want.
I want to know, because if the culture has everything goes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I want to know where that line is. Right. Because, I mean, I kind of know for myself, but I don't know, maybe I'm not accurate. I don't know. I'm trying to figure it out.
Yeah.
For my daughter, I mean, I think I figured it out, but I mean, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
I might have missed it from the previous class, but what would you say is the purpose?
I haven't. That's next week.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm going to do that. I'm going to talk about that next week.
Okay.
That's hand up 3.5.
But. Yeah. Yeah. Is that okay? Can we wait?
That's
great. Okay.
No, Jack,
okay. Can I go on? Point G. A desire is not a license to act to fulfill it. Neither is it a prima facie justification for any action. Prima facie means just on the surface, justification right on the surface of it. So, unlike modern culture, if you want something, you just go get it, right? You get satisfied. We even get a sense of entitlement. This gentleman in Santa Barbara again. If I have a desire, that entitles me to have it fulfilled, and you know, damn anyone who gets in the way of me fulfilling it. The point is that with respect to sexuality, self-control is no less essential or important with regard to our sexual desires than it is with respect to any other desires that we have. Self-control is critical. The thing that's astonishing is the in antiquity, the pagans understood that better than we modern Christians do today. That's incredible. they recognized what a wild and crazy thing their bodies were. They recognized that, and they recognized that the virtue we needed to develop was self-control, to have power of my understanding and my wisdom, my moral judgment needs to take power over the wayward, wild, crazy, uncontrollable desires that are given to me by my body. The tendency is that even in Christian culture, I think, we don't really think in those terms. We don't really appreciate the importance of that and the need for that. That's part of righteousness, I would argue. Self-control comes up in Paul's list twice, I think. Maybe more than twice. But one of the fruit of the Spirit is self-control, having some kind of mastery of over yourself. And it's not just physical desires, but physical, emotional, or psychological in nature. Self-control is the choice to do what is morally right at the expense of not satisfying some desire that I have. That's what I mean by self-control. I have the will to choose what is right, even though that by choosing what is right, I'm going to go without. And it's not just sexuality, it's not just physical desires, like hunger, for example. I mean, notice the self-control that Jesus in his temptation. You could turn these stones into bread. Well, that would work. That would satisfy your hunger. Yeah, but satisfying my hunger is not the right thing right now. So I choose not to act in a way to satisfy my desire. But it can be emotional desires. It can be psychological desires. They can torment us every bit as much as physical desires can. I feel lonely. I need to have my loneliness taken care of and met. That can drive you to all kinds of irresponsible behaviors, socially and personally irresponsible, immoral, even perverse behavior, just because I'm lonely. I need significance. We can go really crazy places because we have this, I think, God-given desire for significance, but we don't always experience ourselves as significant, and we desperately want that desire to be met and that desire to be fulfilled. Well, what do we do with it? Are we willing to live here not experiencing the significance that I long for and that I want? Or am I willing to do anything in order to get it? Sometimes people become downright delusional about their own significance in order to satisfy that need to be significant. Well, it's way more righteous and godly to have both feet planted in reality, in the world I actually live in, than to live in some fantasy land. This is the moral choice. Live in the place where you find yourself. Stay there and learn what you need to learn and do what's right. Make good and right moral choices in the context in which God has you planted. Don't escape into some fantasy land. That's a moral choice. And the psychological ramifications of delusion are tremendous. So let's not go there. Well, with our sexuality then, that same kind of self-control needs to be practiced. Just because I want something doesn't mean I have a right or a license or I'm entitled to have it, to satisfy the desire. So especially because we know from the biblical perspective who we are. We are sinful, rebellious, depraved beings, creatures. So it follows from the intrinsic nature of righteousness and from the intrinsically sinful nature that characterizes us as human beings that to want something is never in and of itself a license to act in such a way as to satisfy it. Because there's always the possibility that the desire itself is wrong. And I'll talk about that more in a second here. So in the context of biblical sexual ethics, no human being is free to simply follow his desires. The Bible does not place this limitation only on some sexual desires. It places this limitation on every sexual desire of every person. For the desires of each and every one of us are all too often evil. And when they're not evil, they nonetheless may, love and goodness may demand that I not satisfy them. So contrast that with the modern mindset. Whatever sexual desires and urges one experiences are indicators of objective relational truth. That's what the modern mind thinks. To experience sexual attraction to a person, to a woman I am not married to, for example, is an indication that I am meant to have an intimate relationship with that woman. I mean, how often does that happen in the movies? Two people are going along, married, ordinary lives of being married, and then all of a sudden the woman comes into the guy's life and he falls madly and terribly in love with the woman. Well, everything about the way the movie is constructed makes us cheer for him if he gets the woman. And you think, never mind his wife and children and everything else that he's destroying and throwing away in his life and the tragedy of that. Sometimes the movies show the tragedy of that, but there's always a little bit of ambivalence. Yeah, it's tragic. Isn't it too bad that getting what is good and wonderful and beautiful has a tragic side to it? Isn't that too bad? No, it's immoral, is what it is. From a biblical perspective, I've made a choice for folly and sin and unrighteousness instead of righteousness. But the modern culture says there's something about that desire that somehow warrants you having it and you going for it. It's an indication I'm meant to have an intimate relationship with that woman. That is, either I'm meant to divorce my wife and marry that woman, or I'm meant to have an extramarital affair with that woman. I am meant to break my marriage vow and pursue the direction my desires have pointed me toward. That's just the way it is. False. That's completely 180 degrees from the biblical perspective. Whatever sexual desires and urges one experiences are urges that could and should be fulfilled, is part of the modern mindset. Or at least one must consider it invalid to restrict or limit the fulfillment of such urges, per se. One can rightly create certain boundaries within which to fulfill such urges, but one cannot rightly invalidate the urge in and of itself as being intrinsically wrong to fulfill it. So that you especially see that today in the homosexual debate. We can require homosexuals to have a lifelong committed relationship. Okay, maybe we can do that. But we can't require them to consider their homosexual desires as being desires that should never, under any circumstance, be acted on. Why not? Because they have desires. Because there are desires there. And that's what I'm arguing is the underlying assumption behind that, prejudice behind that is desires are self-justifying. Our desires are self-justifying in the sense that they justify my satisfying them. There's no real value in saying no to our desires or our passions and in choosing not to fulfill them. There may be value in restricting or channeling those passions such that we only fulfill them in a particular way or in particular circumstances, but there is no need to say no to them altogether. Well, that's always been a temptation throughout all of human history to take that position. Why should I have to say no to my desires? But what's different today is the very loud voice of a culture that's joined the voice of the tempter and is just screaming at us to look at my desires as being inherently entitling me to satisfy them. Next point is not all sexual desires are equal. Even to be interested in a sexual act that transgresses the bounds of morality is an indication of my depravity and my perversion. Jesus teaches that wanting to commit adultery is the moral equivalent of adultery itself. And I need to make a point about that. It's the moral equivalent. It's not the social equivalent. To commit adultery has interpersonal and social fallout, results, consequences that are far more devastating than just lusting after a woman. I mean, that's just clearly true. The social consequences are greater. But the point that Jesus is making is not that somehow, I mean, I knew a guy once who made the argument that Jesus said that lusting after a woman is the same as committing adultery with a woman. I'm lusting after the woman, so I might as well commit adultery with a woman. Genius argument. But what's completely fallacious about that is what Jesus was talking about are not the social consequences of your action. Some things, the consequences, the evils, get compounded over and over and over and over again and are made greater and greater and greater by the choices you make. Well, don't do that. even if you've committed the evil of lusting, don't do the rest of it. I mean, that's a good thing to do, is to restrain yourself. Jesus' point is different. And when you lust after a woman and wish you could commit adultery with her, but don't then turn around and pat yourself on the back and say, what a righteous boy I am. His point is, you want evidence of your depravity? It's in the very beginning of the process right there. Your interest, your being intrigued with the idea, your being fascinated with the idea was in and of itself emblematic of your depravity, symptomatic of your depravity. Don't call it righteousness when you, out of fear or fear of opprobrium by other people, social censure by other people, are timid enough to stay within the bounds of, and not actually commit adultery. Actually, what you are is an immoral coward, is what you are. You're not a righteous person. You're just too afraid to cross the boundaries and do what you really want to do. But you want to do it. So don't call that good. Don't call that righteousness. Don't call that wisdom. Paul explicitly describes desires as being evil in Colossians 3:5, and I have a list of Greek words there. One of them there is epithumia kake, evil desire. So it's possible for our desires themselves to be immoral and perverse.
Jack, let me just ask you to clarify that. Back on page 11, 3a, last sentence in that paragraph is the desires of each and every one of us. All too often they're evil. The point you just made, Paul explicitly describes desires as evil. How far are we going I'm thinking that you're not saying all desires without question at all times are evil.
No, not at all. No, I'm just saying that's a legitimate category. I'm putting that up against what I think is a more modern mindset, and that is no desire is evil. It's only how you act that's evil, but no desire is evil. Okay, the next point, biblical ethics is not a consequentialist ethics, and I think we've already talked about this in the course of questions in the past, so I won't dwell on this. That is, a behavior is wrong not because it has harmful consequences. It is wrong because it is an act of rebellion against God and his purposes in the created order. Whether it has harmful consequences in my estimation or not doesn't really make any difference. Now, mostly when you transgress God's purposes, oftentimes, typically, there will be harmful consequences, but that's not what made it evil. What made it evil is not the fact that it had harmful consequences. What made it evil is that it was rooted in this rebellion against God and his purposes. And so even if I escape the harmful consequences somehow, that hasn't somehow made my action good rather than evil. So even if there is no obvious identifiable victim of my behavior, it may still be evil and unrighteous. So in the context of biblical ethics, there is such a thing as a victimless evil. There are things that we... let's take idolatry. I think I used that before. Idolatry is clearly evil. God calls it abominable. Well, who's the victim? God? He's a big boy. He can take care of himself. He doesn't have a shaky self-concept. His self-concept is very, very healthy. He's not going to be intimidated if I neglect to worship him in the way that I do. So he's not really a significant victim. Nobody else is a victim of my idolatry. But yet it's an abominable perversion, a terrible evil from a biblical perspective. Sexual behavior willingly engaged in by two consenting adults may be utterly evil and depraved, regardless of the fact that the participants are willing. Their willingness doesn't make it right. Not all sexual behaviors are acceptable, and then I make the point that we just talked about. Sexual perversion within the context of marriage or a consenting partner is still sexual perversion. Being sexually perverse with one spouse does not somehow make it moral just because it's with my spouse. And then I had two final points that I wanted to make in this section. One of them we talked about last week, the first one, the tension between the animalistic, biologically driven sexual response as opposed to sexual desire. I make a distinction there. How I respond biologically, that's never, I don't think, ever held in moral judgment, never condemned by the Bible. It's when it rises to the level of desire. And I think I would know it in my own case. I don't know that I can define it for you, but it's when that response leads me to be intrigued by something. It's interesting to me. It's thinkable to me. Even if it's not thinkable that I would ever act, it's thinkable to me as an interesting possibility. I wish I had the moral freedom to do it, kind of thing. You know, the thing standing between me and it is this damned morality. It's standing in the way. I, that I could live in a world where we could remove the morality, because that looks interesting to me. I think that's a desire. And that's the kind of thing that Paul is saying that's already evil. And we can, I mean, who of us can even imagine not having evil desires? I can't imagine not having evil desires. The kind of innocence that we would have is just so not me, and it's so not you, I think. I mean, the only one I can imagine having that kind of innocence is Jesus, where all he has to do is note the fact that something would be wrong, and that sucks the intrigue and interest and curiosity right out of him. That would be wrong. But do you realize in the context of our culture, and it's not just our culture, I think this is the context of humanity, the context of world culture throughout all human history, what do human beings think of that kind of innocent person? They almost despise them for their lack of sophistication. I mean, you're just terribly square. I mean, how square can you get that you don't see how interesting that might be, that evil thing? I mean, I can understand you having the moral scruples to not do it, but come on, you got to at least acknowledge that it's interesting. But I'm sorry. I think Jesus would say, I'm sorry, it's not interesting to me. Why would that be interesting to me? I wish I could be that kind of person who could just respond, why would that be interesting to me? That would be perfection, I think. That would be to be void of all evil desire. So finally, now, and I'll end with this. The fact of human sinfulness and human depravity, moral depravity, has some certain ramifications, I think. First, I should expect that my sexual desires and behaviors will be immoral and perverse. So recognize that in a biblical perspective, in a biblical worldview, the goal is not purity. It's too late for that. It's been too late from that since Adam. So purity is not realistic. It's not the goal. We shouldn't expect it of one another. We shouldn't expect it of ourselves. We're going to demonstrate in many, many different ways how depraved and perverse we are. Okay, that's a given. So the point of the biblical sexual ethics is not to give us a tool to get on our moral high horse and feel all self-righteous because we think we're better than other people. We're all in the same boat. Every single one of us, because the biblical worldview makes it clear that I'm depraved.
Don't you want to try to strive towards that, though?
Yeah, that's the third point.
Okay. I'm going to make.
The second point, I have to have. Oh no, okay. I guess I made that as a second point. The realistic expectation for my existence is not sexual purity. And the third one that I didn't make it into the notes, and I realized that too late. That I would make a third one there, and that is. But the biblical expectation is. I'm going to be captivated by the vision of being a different kind of human being than I am, a righteous one rather than an unrighteous one. And I'm going to commit my life, make an existential commitment to strive to emulate that righteousness rather than the unrighteousness that comes so naturally to me. Now, will I make it? No, I'm going to fail along the way, but not for lack of trying. I mean, what makes a follower of Jesus a follower of Jesus is not that he succeeds at being righteous, but that he's trying to be righteous. And that's not nothing. It speaks volumes about my heart. It speaks volumes about my personal existential commitment that defines the kind of person that I am. When I fail, I call it a failure. When I fail, I don't rationalize it and blame someone else or decide we need to lower the bar and redefine righteousness because this is too difficult for me, so I need to redefine it. No, we let righteousness be righteousness. We let ourselves be captivated by the kind of purity of righteousness that we are ultimately destined for and ultimately called to, and we strive to do everything we can to have our lives conform to that, knowing all along, realistically, that I'm going to stumble and stumble again in the process of doing that. But I'm going to get up and keep going because that's what I want to be. That's who I want to be. So in the realm of sexuality, so we strive for sexual purity, even if we're very ungraceful and bumbling at it. But we're committed to it because it's right and good and true and what it means to be obedient to God. Okay? Sorry. So next week is our last week. We'll wrap it up and I'll talk about the Bible's theory of sex and what role sex plays and what its purpose is.
Can we get past the introduction next week?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right into the heart of it. Yeah.